Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And as I promised, we're going to go back in history a couple of hundred years anyway from what we were just talking about with our last guest, Michael Stevens. And we're going to take a look at Jean Nicolet. What you learned about Jean Nicolet in school was likely wrong. And we're going to find out about that. Oh, look at all those paintings and all those statues and the historical plaques that are around here in Wisconsin about him are likely pretty wrong. Patrick Young, our next guest, he's an assistant professor of history at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, and he's the author of many articles on military and American Indian history. And the book we're going to be talking about today with him, it's his latest, it's called The Misunderstood Mission of Jean Nicolet, Uncovering the Story of the 1634 Journey. So what was your understanding of Jean Nicolet's journey to the area we now call Wisconsin? What questions do you have about researching books like this? We'd love to hear from you. You can become a part of our conversation. The number to join us is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Patrick Young, by the way, he's with us from our Milwaukee studios, so it's good to have our folks in Milwaukee helping us out here. Patrick Young, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I tell you what, I was fascinated by your book, and I was thinking, all these things that I learned about Jean Nicolet when I was in grade school and later on weren't really true.
No, they weren't. They were, it was nobody's fault. Nobody intentionally set to mislead everyone. It was just sort of a culmination of errors over time that just became dogma. And trying to disprove a lot of that was a pretty daunting task.
Well, you're a guy who's, you're involved in the Milwaukee School of Engineering. You're a history professor. You've done a lot in the history area. What draws you to history, a guy that kind of is an engineer, too?
Well, first of all, I'm not an engineer. My doctoral degree was in history with an emphasis in cultural anthropology. And I've just always been interested in other cultures, different parts of the world. And ever since I was a little kid, and I first learned about Jean Nicolet when I was in fourth grade at 81st Street School here in Milwaukee. I spent most of my life here in Milwaukee. And I learned the wrong story then. And it took many years of research to unthink that.
Well, first, let's go with what was right. Tell us the story as we heard it when we were all in fourth grade, just to remind people what we were told.
Okay. Well, first of all, Nicolet, especially probably up until maybe 20 years ago, was hailed as the first white man in Wisconsin, the first European in Wisconsin. And that holds true. That's probably true. I can come back to that point later. So there were certain parts of the story that, were undoubtedly accurate. But the main thrust of the story was that Nicolet's purpose in coming to Wisconsin was that he was looking for the famed Northwest Passage, a waterway that would connect the Atlantic to the Pacific Oceans and ultimately provide easy access to China and the rich Asia trade. And in preparation for his meeting with what he thought would be the Ming Emperor, he wore a Chinese robe when he got to Green Bay, thinking he had kind of navigated the Northwest Passage, and he was now somewhere on the far reaches of Asia, and that he would soon meet the Ming Emperor. And that's what everybody was told. It's in all the books. It's on all the historical markers. It's going to take a long time for that idea to fade. And I can, when you start looking at how that whole idea developed. It's easy to see where the early historians made their mistakes, why they made their mistakes, and then why later historians just kind of accepted the story without questioning it.
Yeah. When did you first start questioning what we all learned?
Well, first of all, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the person who deserves a lot of credit for this is the late Nancy Oestreich Lurie. She was the curator of North American ethnology at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and she just died about 2 years ago. She was a very prolific scholar, and she had spent her career researching the Ho-Chunk Indians of Wisconsin, going all the way back to the 1940s. And in the early 1960s, she began to look into Jean Nicolet, who was the first European also to make contact with the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk. And she began to realize that if she could learn more about Nicolet, she could learn more about the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk Indians. So she began to research this in the early 60s, and that's about the time I was born. And it was in 2005. I had met her. I had worked at the Public Museum as a graduate student. By that time, she was already retired and was, was on emeritus status. But she continued to research the issue of Nicolet. And it was in 2005. I had just finished the final draft of my book on the Black Hawk War, which was the last Indian war fought in Wisconsin. And she said, "Well, now that you're done with that, I'd really like your help researching Nicolet." And Nancy and I were kind of a good team. She was a cultural anthropologist who dabbled in history, and I'm an historian who dabbles in cultural anthropology. So we both had gaps in our knowledge, and we were both able to sort of fill in the other person's gaps. And we were able to I wrote with Nancy back in – we had our first book published on Nicolet in 2009. And a lot of what's in the current book was actually written in that book as well. But Nancy also wrote that book for a very specific audience. It's very technical at times. And ultimately I began to – as I continued to research it, came to disagree with her on some of her conclusions.
And your book is certainly, let me put it this way. I think it's a more entertaining read than her book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I say, when I was invited to write with Nancy in 2005, she had spent a long career researching the earliest history of the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk. And she basically invited me onto her book project to fill in some of the gaps she was having problems with. So it was her book. I knew this would be one of her last books. She wasn't slowing down then, but I knew that she was, coming to the end of her career. So, I kind of played second fiddle, and that was a conscious decision on my part. And at the time, I was not real familiar with a lot of the archaeology, which is really a key component to understanding a lot of the story. And after the book came out, I started working with another scholar, David Overstreet, who's he's a well-known archaeologist here in the state of Wisconsin, and he also worked with Nancy earlier in his career. And I've kind of picked, a lot of the research I've done, I've started to work with David Overstreet quite a bit to get the full archaeological picture. And we both came to the conclusion that we understand why Nancy came up with some of the ideas she did. And it was important that they be put in print, and I want to stress that. With some of these, really early aspects of North American history, the records and the data is very, very incomplete. And I think it's really important that even theories and hypotheses that are questionable be put out so they can be discussed. So we just started to see why Nancy came to some of the conclusions she did, why some of those conclusions are probably not completely accurate. And I worked a lot of that new material into this book.
Really interesting. And one of the things that struck me was your support of, and I think I agree with, I'm sure I agree with you on this, is some people do not feel that oral histories, as we have with our natives, with our Indian tribes, is not good research if you rely at all on oral traditions. And that's simply... isn't true, is it?
If you don't look at oral traditions, I think you're cutting out an important source that that illuminates other sources. And to just kind of, put it in relatively simple terms, there's really three main sources of information you need for a topic like this, where you're going back to the early 17th century, the very earliest contact between Europeans and native peoples here in Wisconsin. You certainly need to look at the written records of the French. That's absolutely critical. You need to look at the archaeological evidence. That's also critical. And the third major important source is the oral traditions as they were recorded. And as far as the oral traditions, I mean, I didn't have to sit down with any, elders to get any of the oral traditions. They were recorded by various anthropologists, Indian agents, going all the way back to the 1820s. And I tried to go back for the earliest oral traditions with the idea that they would probably be some of the richest, and that I wasn't disappointed.
Well, it certainly makes for a wonderful read, and I like the fact that you talk about the fact that you can't talk about Jean Nicolet without talking about Samuel de Champlain. Mm-hmm. And I really wondered after reading through your book, well, how would you have done it otherwise? You had to really, in some ways, highlight him more than Nicolet.
Yeah, and again, when I was – the first book I worked on with Nancy Lurie, what she really wanted to emphasize was not just John Nicolet. She wanted to get that part of the story right. But she also wanted to present a lot of her theories on the ancestors of the contemporary Ho-Chunk Indians. So a lot of what research I had done on Champlain was given somewhat short shrift. But again, it was her book project, and I thought it was important that it was published. After that, I said, well, a lot of what when you look at Champlain's career, it illuminates a lot of what Nicolet did. I mean, there's hundreds of pages written by Champlain about Champlain. He wrote four major books, all of which have been translated. Nicolet, we have a total of four total printed pages, and it's pretty thin.
Pretty thin. Well, I tell you what, we're going to hear what was the truth about Jean Nicolet's 1634 journey to Wisconsin. We'll take a look first at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guest, Patrick Young, author of The Misunderstood Mission of Jean Nicolet. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking about Jean Nicolet and his journey to Green Bay in 1634. I've got 1834 here on my notes, and I know that's wrong. It's 1634. Our guest is Patrick Young. He is an assistant professor of history at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, the author of many articles on military and American Indian history. His new book is called The Misunderstood Mission of Jean Nicolet, Uncovering the Story of the 1634 Journey. So what questions do you have about our area at the time of those first European explorers back in the 1600s? Have you done some historical research? What draws you to history? Love to hear from you. Be a part of our conversation by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Patrick Young, our guest. And what we learned in school, probably fourth grade, about Jean Nicolet was pretty much not correct at all. We're learning now what did happen and maybe why we've learned what we learned from Patrick Young. This is great to have him along. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Well, we were talking about Samuel de Champlain, and what part did he play in Nicolet's journey, and why was it necessary to spend so much time talking maybe a little more about Champlain's life?
Well, first of all, Champlain's career, Nicolet was a diplomat, first and foremost. He was a diplomat to Indian nations on behalf of Champlain. And Champlain, of course, did a lot of diplomacy himself. And when we look at a lot of Champlain's diplomacy with, say, the Iroquois of upstate New York, it's very similar to many of the things that Nicolet did among the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk at Green Bay. So we have a lot more information on Champlain's diplomacy. So again, it illuminates a lot of the rather somewhat ambiguous and poorly documented aspects of Nicolet's journey. And again, his journey to Green Bay in 1634 was purely diplomatic. He was there to basically make peace between the tribes of Lake Huron, who were allied to the French, and the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk, who were frequently enemies of the Lake Huron Indians. So, you know, he had a diplomatic role to play. And he never wore a Chinese robe, and I can't go into all the details on that. He was wearing a silk cape, very similar to what Frenchmen of his age wore. So
that makes a lot of sense. Jeff in Madison has a question or comment for us. Let's go there. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just, again, taken with how often what we read hundreds of years later is really kind of a narrative done by the person, of course, that's there writing it. And I think to them, a lot of times they didn't know they were writing history. They were just recording the scene in front of them. And in my mind, the biggest thing, I got more time in Idaho and Montana, so out there it's all about Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea. And, you know, not to drag from the current topic, but Charbonneau, who was Sacagawea's husband, had a second wife. And you never hear anything about that. Likewise, Sacagawea had a second kid, which you never hear about. So, you know, according to the people who were there, those things that I guess weren't a big deal, according to the one with the pen and paper and the education that could write. So,
yeah. Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Well, that brings up the whole, to me, where the misunderstanding came regarding the robe versus the cape, and you explain that in your book, Patrick.
Yeah, and let me just kind of address something the caller alluded to. First of all, you know, he's 100% right. Most of the time when historians are using historical sources, the people who wrote them they weren't trying to record history. They had some other purpose. Now, as far as Nicolet, we know he was literate. He did write something down, although it doesn't survive. We just have glosses written by two French Jesuit priests. And one of them was essentially writing Nicolet's obituary in 1642. So the information, its purpose was not so much to record, you know, details about his journey, but just to provide something of an overview of his life. And it was written very generally. So written sources, sometimes they're very voluminous. In the case of Champlain, he wrote in great detail about what he did. Nicolet, he didn't write anything that survives, and we only have really these two very, very ambiguous and somewhat, you know, general accounts written by two French priests. And again, it was over the course – when they began to research Nicolet's life about back in 1850, in the 1850s, they had just these really four printed pages of material on them. And they had to try to fill in these rather big gaps. The big thing about the Chinese robe was this. Nicolet was described by one of the French priests as wearing a robe of China damask. Well, the word robe was mistranslated from French into English as robe. It should have been translated as cape. China damask was simply a type of silk that was made in France. And that was Nancy's big discovery, that he was just wearing a typical silk cape that, you know, if you think Three Musketeers and what they wore, that's what Nicolet was wearing. And that sort of demolished the idea that he was looking for the Northwest Passage. And it was clear from Champlain's writings that he had given up on the project of the Northwest Passage probably 10 years before. And he was really interested in sealing, you know, strong relationships with regional tribes for trade. So, again, it was looking at a lot of Champlain's writings to figure out what he was thinking, because he was the one who ordered Nicolet westward. There's really no doubt about that. And he ordered him to make peace between New France's Indian allies and the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk. And a silk cape would have been sort of de rigueur for a diplomatic mission back in the early 1600s.
Yeah. Champlain was an interesting guy in that the people that he sent out, the young guys that he sent out to do some of his work, he made sure they had some training in native languages and the the sort of the sociology of the peoples.
Well, if you want to call it training, basically what they did is they took young French boys, probably 13 or 14 years old, and they simply, you know, set them to live with the Indians really for the rest of their lives. And Nicolet, he spent for, you know, most of the time he lived along the northern shore of Lake Huron with the Nipissing Indians, probably the Algonquians. And, I mean, he lived with them. He probably saw Frenchmen once in a while. He would take the trade fleets down to the St. Lawrence River in the summer when he would have contact with Frenchmen again, and then he would go back to live with the Indians for the rest of the year. So they were – it was kind of like a cultural and linguistic immersion by living with the Indians.
Yeah.
They didn't really live with, you know, the Truchemonts, the interpreters. They didn't live among the French. They lived among the Indians.
Phil in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Phil.
Hey, I got a question. What did Nicolet have anything to do with the trade and going all the way to New Orleans with that group? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, no, that would be a later generation. It would be LaSalle who would be, and that would be in the 1680s. That was like a full 50 years after Nicolet. Nicolet has his journey in 1634, and there were probably some isolated visits to Green Bay in the 1640s. But the region was engulfed in a series of Indian wars, and the French really don't make a comeback until the 1650s, 20 years later. And the French missions aren't established among the Indians till the 1660s, 1670s. And LaSalle doesn't complete his journey down the Mississippi until the 1680s. And that was – so, you know, in one sense, Nicolet is the first of several French explorers and French agents to come through.
And he was – they were in Quebec, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. to begin with. New France, it was called.
Right. And but at the time of Nicolet's journey, Quebec was really the only settlement, and it never had more than 100 people, you know, by the time of his journey. In the 1630s, they began to set up isolated trading posts downriver from Quebec. But, you know, French Canada was still very, very young, and it would not be until 20 years after Nicolet's death that the population even hit 1,000.
And at the time, at his time, there were the Indian tribes were pretty vast.
Their population densities were quite a bit lower than probably any place in Europe. But there were probably 30,000 to 40,000 Iroquois living in upstate New York. The Hurons probably numbered about 20,000. And the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk probably numbered about 20,000 as well. And one thing I do want to stress, I went into this book with the question of what was the nature of his mission. That was absolutely critical because I have a much bigger and much more important question to answer, and that is, who are the people whom Nicolet met? And that I'm currently working on with several other scholars, trying to get a picture of the human geography of Wisconsin in 1634. That's a far more daunting task, and that might be several generations before we get a real firm idea of what the human geography of the region looked like at the time of his visit.
Mary in Madison would like to know about the importance of beaver pelts to the Indians in trading with Europeans.
Well, they were absolutely critical, but the fur trade wouldn't really be established until about the 1650s, 1660s. So again, that's 20, 30 years post-Nicolet. Beaver itself was important to the Indians. They made a lot of their robes from it, but it was absolutely essential to the French trade. But the trade with the tribe, the French had established trade with the Indians of the St. Lawrence during the time of Champlain and Nicolet. The trade with the Western nations, as they were called, in Wisconsin into the Mississippi Valley, that really didn't begin to develop until at the earliest 1650s, and that's 20 years after Nicolet's visit.
So why did Champlain want to send Nicolet to Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, the French kind of come into a situation where you have a lot of warring tribes. The tribes of the St. Lawrence were constantly at war with the Iroquois in upstate New York. And there was basically a buffer zone from the St. Lawrence all the way into the Finger Lakes district of New York that was kind of a no man's land. And he realized in order to keep the wheels of the trench trade network going, he had to try to keep warfare down to a minimum. And again, we have a lot of information from Champlain's writings about his diplomatic efforts with the Iroquois. It's clear by the 1630s that the French allies along Lake Huron, the Huron Indians, the Ottawas, the Algonquians, the Nipissings, they are in this intermittent war with the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk farther to the west at Green Bay. Champlain doesn't have an army. He doesn't even have any soldiers. The only way that he realistically can try to keep warfare to a minimum or try to, you know, to stymie it all together is through diplomacy. And again, we have many instances of his Iroquois diplomacy and the young men he sent as diplomats to the Iroquois, one of whom was Nicolet. Nicolet had actually been part of this peace offensive in the 1620s with the Iroquois. And he was simply reprising his role in 1634 with the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk at Green Bay.
Really, really interesting. We can take some more calls. Again, by the way, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Rosie in Ashland next. Rosie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I got my basic history, and maybe some of it wrong, but I do better with historical fiction than actual history. So Kenneth Roberts was one of my favorite early authors about this time frame. An early, easy way into history, shall we say.
Well, Patrick, what do you think?
Well, I'm a big fan of historical fiction, too. If it's well-researched, it can be really good. And this is really kind of a dramatic period. And again, we have sort of really, you know, in many cases, scanty records of what's happening. It is nice when you get someone with a creative flair who can fill some of that in with some of the drama that we know must be played out behind the scenes. I tried to put as much of that drama into my own book as I could, but I had to basically go with the sources I had, and I wasn't allowed to, you know, creatively put in anything fictional. So, but yeah, it would. I've often thought that if you know, in the hands of the right, you know, author, the story of Nicolet would make a wonderful piece of historical fiction, and you know.
Yeah,
you just have to fill in some gaps with some creative writing.
And let's talk some more about his trip, because he went. Well, there was even some controversy about this, but I think you probably have things correct as to how he traveled and how long it took and so forth.
Yeah, and again, we know from other sources, it's not just Champlain's writings. We also have the works of another missionary. Champlain wasn't a missionary, but one of the missionaries he brought over was Sagard. And Sagard did a lot of writing as well, and we get a lot from him. We know in the 1620s, the Ottawas were regularly making trips to Green Bay and to Lake Superior from where they lived on Lake Huron. So Nicolet didn't, you know, Nicolet was making a journey that Indians had made probably for the 200 years before he got there. And it's clear from the French sources that, you know, Nicolet is not doing anything American Indian people hadn't done. He's making a trip from Lake Huron to Lake Michigan. It had been done probably hundreds, thousands of times before, you know, he arrived on the scene. And again, the French admit this. I mean, a lot of it's just later writers who they looked at sources in isolation. They didn't look at, you know, the full context of other French sources. And they just didn't quite understand that what Nicolet was doing wasn't that unusual for the native people. The only difference is he was the first Frenchman to do it. Most likely, there may have been an earlier Frenchman in Wisconsin. But once again, the records are so scant as, you know, you can't draw any firm conclusions.
Well, they were great canoeists, for sure.
Yes, they were.
The trip that he took, what did it take? I forgot now how many weeks.
I go through all the possibilities in there, but you know, they could easily make 50 or 60 miles a day canoeing, even on, you know, the rather clogged waterways of like some of the rivers and everything. So I think I'd have to like turn to chapter 4 to look at it, but it probably took them at least probably less than a month to get from, you know, the northern Lake Huron to Green Bay, another, you know, maybe month or so to get back. At the most, it took 2 months. They could make pretty incredible speeds. You know, they could portage, you know, 6 mile portages, and they could do it in a relatively short amount of time. They were just, you know, American Indians were just, you know, just inured to physical work and physical labor, and even the French were amazed by some of the things that they were able to do.
And he arrived, and when he finally did arrive, he didn't go directly to the Puan, the forerunners of the Ho-Chunk, to their place. He kind of walked there, hid the canoes.
And we do have from Barthélemy Vimont. He's one of the French priests. We know that wherever he stopped, he walked. Where exactly Nicolet landed is a huge question. And there have been a huge number of possibilities that have been presented, some of them strong, most of them weak. Nancy and I, when we were working on the first book, we figured that, you know, the best possibility was Marinette, Wisconsin. Not Red Banks. There's a historical marker there. That's right across Green Bay, north of Green Bay, the city of Green Bay. It wasn't there. There's another one in Menasha, Wisconsin. He definitely didn't land there. But the evidence, and again, it's very thin, but we figured the strongest possibility for a landing site was Marinette, Wisconsin.
And there were, when he arrived, there were a few thousand Puans there.
Well, you have to read a bit between the lines. Most likely he stopped somewhere near Little and Big Bay to Nock, which is at the very north end of Green Bay. He most likely walked from there down to where Marinette is. We know there was a major Menominee village there. It's clear he went to a Menominee village, not to a Puan. The Puan, that was the French word for the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk. They were right across the bay, so that wouldn't have presented a problem. It's clear that the thousands of Indians who assembled at this Menominee village probably did so over the course of a week or two. But, you know, most of them had never seen a European. And sure, I'm sure they had heard of Europeans because they had had contact with the Ottawas and other tribes. But to get your first glimpse of a European, that would have been sort of a treat. So it's clear that he was probably there for at least a week, and the Indians just assembled from everywhere. And he successfully concluded a peace treaty, which unfortunately didn't last very long, maybe about 2 years. But he did at least make an initial peace with the Puan, the ancestors of the Ho-Chunk and the Indians of Lake Huron.
And he was not really looking for the Northwest Passage.
Not at all. And again, it's clear from a lot of different things in Champlain's writings. First of all, he had given up on the idea of the Northwest Passage probably as early as 1624. He didn't think that there was a way through North America by the Great Lakes. He thought so early in his career, but by the 1620s, he knew that the Great Lakes was not going to offer a passage to the Pacific. So that idea was gone. What the big problem that early historians had is they had this description of the cape that Nicolet was wearing, and they mistook it for a Chinese robe. They married that up with the fact that in his early career, Champlain did look for the Northwest Passage, but then they ignored the parts of his writings where he clearly was, you know, not looking for it anymore by the 1630s. And it's clear in his writings that the security of the colony of Quebec and the trade network he had built was paramount in his mind. And that explains Nicolet's mission to a T.
Well, I tell you, this is a fascinating book, Patrick. I know you're going to be reading tonight at Muskego Public Library in Muskego.
Yes, at 7 o'clock tonight in Muskego, 7 p.m. Public Library.
And Kakana Public Library in Kakana on April 23rd. And I'm sure that you have up on the Wisconsin State Historical Society website other times that you'll be speaking.
Yeah, I've got another one in May 20th at Sturgeon Bay. I think I've got like five of them coming up. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunities, and I'll be more than happy to meet members of the general public and take their questions.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Okay, thank you.
Patrick Young, our guest today. His book is really fascinating. We barely scratched the surface of it. It's called The Misunderstood Mission of Jean Nicolet, Uncovering the Story of the 1634 Journey. Oh, boy. How history. Well, thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.